Hello, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN as we continue on this Wednesday morning. My next guest is the president and scientific director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. And he's been working on UFO studies for years. And his name is Mark Rediger. And we've got some stuff that happened on this date. This is a kind of an important anniversary in the look back. The U.S. Air Force reports on Roswell back in June 24th on this date in 1997. So let's bring Mark on. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
I appreciate the opportunity to talk about UFOs tonight.
Yeah. It's interesting. How did you get started in that study?
Well, I grew up in Northwest Indiana, so I was close to Chicago and Dr. Hynek, and that made a difference because when I was a college student, he started the center in the fall of 1973, I actually went to Indiana University for my undergrad. So when I came home in the summer, I thought, you know, I'd always been interested in UFOs, like a lot of kids in the 60s, and I thought, I want to get seriously involved. And so I contacted him and the organization. And, you know, he actually didn't want to have young undergrads involved. It took a little persuasion on my part, but I finally convinced him that I could make a contribution. I volunteered, and I have stuck with it ever since.
So was this something that was with you? I mean, you just said, was this something that was with you? Were you always fascinated by this, even when you were a kid?
Yeah, I would say the earliest I can remember, reading books about it was maybe 9 or 10 years old. I was born in 53. And when I was growing up, UFOs were very much in the news, you know, even more than now. And so I also was interested in the space program and things like that. And it just kind of all came together in my mind. And the other thing is I found out later, is I appreciated what people were saying. You know, I believe people when they say they see something, even when I was a kid. And so I read as much as I could, but I didn't join. There were UFO groups around before the center, but I didn't join them. I stuck to my studies and did the things that kids do. But there was a giant UFO wave of sightings in the fall of 1973, mostly in the southeast U.S., and that's one of the reasons that Dr. Hynek founded the center.
Oh.
And I, of course, followed that closely, and like I said, you know, that kind of even reinforced my interest. You know, I was now grown and, you know, able to do things in college. And I thought, you know, this is the time to take action and to get involved. And it's worked out really well.
Oh, that's great. That's really, really great. Well, what about how is the study of UFOs and extraterrestrials, how is it perceived? You know, because I know that there might be kind of like a cloud over it, because some people think, oh, UFOs, you know, extraterrestrials, it's kind of weird. How is it conceived, especially in the academic community?
Oh, it's always been something that's been verboten, that people look at you with a sideways look. You know, that was true back then, and it's still true today, though. Of course, things are changing a little bit, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, but over the years, it has been so difficult for academics or professionals to get involved that often they wanted to contribute anonymously and wouldn't allow their name to be used, and they certainly wouldn't tell anybody they work with about it. Let me give you a quick 30-second thing. A few years ago, we were contacted by a journalist from a well-known major newspaper that I won't name, but you would easily know its name. And this fellow was one of the editors and had seen a UFO in his backyard, also seen by a neighbor near dusk in the summer. And he called us to talk about it, and also, as people usually do, to see whether anybody else had reported it, which they hadn't. And he said, I cannot talk to anybody in the newsroom. I can't talk to anybody, because if I do, they'll think I'm completely nuts.
Wow.
And that was only maybe, 15 years ago, I'd say.
Wow. All right. So the UFO, the world of UFOs. How many? You know, is there a large contingency of people who study the UFOs? The world of UFOs?
No, not really. There are many people who are interested in it and attend annual meetings or belong to a group called MUFON. They're actually the largest group. The center doesn't take members as such. But the people who are serious, like myself, who spend a lot of time on it, you know, nobody's paid to do this. Everybody's a volunteer. Numbers, you know, more than a handful, but less than a bushel. It's you know, we don't have enough qualified people involved because of all the difficulties in doing this.
Oh, okay. I see. So tell me about, you are part of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. Tell me about J. Allen Hynek.
J. Allen Hynek was really a fascinating guy. I'm so glad I met him because it wasn't just in UFOs. He was a classic scientist, actually a classic absent-minded professor. He once left his briefcase on the Purple Line on his way back from downtown Chicago to his home at Evanston, but fortunately got it back. He had a goatee. He was an astronomer and did that his whole life. A very respected astronomer, not a world class, you know, not the world beater kind, but a very well known guy that did a lot of interesting work in stellar astronomy. He also was one of the first people to get an observatory with a video camera back in the 60s. And so he liked technology and was kind of on the cutting edge with that. In fact, during World War II, he worked on the proximity fuse, which was used by the military, and then he worked on with V-2 rockets that we got from the Germans, of course, right after the war. What was important, and you know, why is he associated with UFOs in the center, is that when the Air Force started looking at UFOs in about June or July of 1947, shortly after that, in early 48, they needed a scientist, an astronomer, who would help them look at the reports they were receiving and just determine whether there was some astronomical explanation, which often there was. And Dr. Hynek then was at Ohio State University, and the Air Force project was in Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which many people have heard of. And so they recruited him, he got involved that way. So he didn't express an interest. It was like, well, okay, if you'll pay me to do this, sure, I'll do it. But when he started doing it and explained a lot of reports, he began to realize, because he was intellectually honest, you know, not only can I not explain some of these look like they're really hard to explain, period. And so his interest was piqued, and things just moved from there.
Okay. Tell me about the actual center for UFO studies.
Right, we're a, you know, a nonprofit group. We're more like a think tank. You know, we don't have public members or all that. We publish monographs and reports, we try to work on special research projects. You know, Roswell was one of our projects. I did a long-term study of people who claim they're abducted by UFOs. We've also looked at UFO history. One of our board members, who is a retired professor at Western Michigan University, and a few other people wrote what I think is the definitive book on the government study of UFOs, not just the U.S. government, but the British government and others. So, you know, we do that, but we also do lectures, do interviews like this, you know, try to inform the public as best we can.
Yeah.
And most important, I suppose, we have the largest collection of UFO cases in the world.
Oh, well, we have to talk about that. Hang on, okay, Mark?
Sure.
All right, there's a lot more to talk about here with Mark Rodiger, and he is the president and scientific director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, and we'll talk more with Mark right after this on WGN. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. And Mark Rodiger is my guest right now. He's the president and scientific director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. And we were just talking about the studies. Now, tell me about the examples you just mentioned before the break about the UFO cases. Tell me about some of them and how many you have.
Well, we think we have, you know, we've never gone through and counted them on paper, and of course we have them electronically now, but we think 80 or 90,000 separate reports.
Wow.
All kinds of report letters from people, really well-investigated reports done by, you know, competent investigators. You know, for one example is we have the original report file for the famous Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. Which occurred in 1961. There was a movie about it and a book about it. And, you know, so we have that. We have original Air Force documents that actually Dr. Hynek, you know, was an Air Force advisor all the way up to the end of the project at the end of the 1960s, and he often, got copies of things that maybe should have stayed in the files. It was a kind of a five-finger discount at the time. So we have that. Of course, we have all kinds of, we have a pieces of material in a few cases, that are said to have come from a UFO. There was something that was reported in, Brazil back in 1957 at Ubatuba on a beach where somebody said a UFO had crashed and they had found pieces, very small pieces of it in the water. And they retrieved it, and, you know, and one thing's led to another, and it's been studied over the years, and we have two pieces of it, and recently we've actually done a reanalysis with the better technology, the more, you know, more capable technology that we have today.
Wow. So, you're talking about some of these cases. What are some of the most sort of notorious or interesting cases that you talked about?
Well, the I think that if the Father Gill case stands out as really an amazing case, it happened in Papua New Guinea, so it didn't happen in the States. But it's an amazing case because it is something that is very hard to discount as not happening. Father Gill was a missionary for the church. And working with the natives, just like you expect, except that he was, you know, got along fabulously with them. And Papua New Guinea, by the way, is a difficult place to do that. And an evening in the late 1950s, when it was just getting dusk, somebody came running to see him and said, "There's some kind of a weird thing in the sky." And he went out to look, along with some of the people in the mission. And there was an object, a classic flying saucer, you know, in the sky, hovering there, completely visible. You know, 2,000 feet up, 1,000 feet up, you know, fairly large, could see it perfectly. It was a disc-shaped thing with a kind of a railing around it. And at one point, an entity came out onto the railing and waved at them. And this was such a clear sight that it can't be an odd plane or some secret project. It was being tested in Papua New Guinea. It wasn't the planet Venus, which some skeptics have said.
Oh, okay.
All these people weren't hallucinating. It wasn't Venus because it was a clearly, you know, distinct object. Nobody had a camera, unfortunately. But the point is that this is a sighting seen by, you know, many people, including this guy who was, is, you know, a fellow who I met, Father Gill, later in the 1970s in Evanston at the center, completely respectable, honest as the day is long. And so, you know, either you have to conclude that everybody there was making this up, right, or they really saw what they saw. And if they saw what they saw, well, you know, you can be the judge of what that means.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Let me ask you this: anniversary about the UFO reports, the UFO studies from the forest reports on Roswell. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, let me start with just one thing first, because June 24th has another important is an important date for another reason. That's the date that a guy named Kenneth Arnold saw 9 UFOs flying in Washington State, and he was a pilot flying looking for a downed plane. And it's his report that began the modern era of UFOs. So you picked a good day to have our discussion here, because that really led everything about it. If you want, you know, just Google Ken Arnold and UFOs, and everybody can read all about that if they haven't heard about it.
Well, just a quick, you can do a quick summation of that.
Right. Well, there was a plane that was down, and Ken Arnold was trying to find it, as were lots of other people. Or at least some people. And he was a pilot. He flew around first part of his job, actually, all over the northwestern U.S. And it was a completely clear day, early afternoon, I don't know the exact time, on June 24th. And he saw 9, not disc-shaped, they were actually kind of boomerang-shaped objects flying between two of the large mountains there, Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. And he was able to time them because he knew the distance between them, and they were traveling somewhat over 1,000 miles an hour in formation. And they just kept going. And, you know, he saw them for a reasonable period of time. They were quite distant from him, so they were very small, but he said he could see enough detail. And there, of course, we didn't have anything that flew 1,000 miles an hour then.
Yeah.
And not 9 things in a formation. So he landed. He told somebody about this. A newspaper guy got a hold of it and put the report in the paper, and all, you know, H broke loose, basically, across the whole country. And what happened was, this was a case of what's called facilitation. Basically, other people had already been seeing UFOs that year. But that report in the newspaper made it okay for people to report what they were seeing.
Oh, I see.
Okay, and so all of a sudden, there were lots of reports, and I do think that there were, in fact, perhaps more UFOs appearing over the next couple of weeks. Roswell itself happened, that is the crash, we think, just about 10 days later. But essentially, that kick-started, the Arnold sighting kick-started the modern UFO era, because since then, UFOs have just been in the news, you know, forever. Now, as I said, 10 days after that or so, what we think was probably July 2nd or July 3rd is when the Roswell crash itself happened back in 1947.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about that, the effects of that crash in 1947. Obviously, you know, people associate, you know, aliens and UFOs with Roswell. It's always forever going to be connected with Roswell. Tell us a bit about the crash and what happened after.
Yes, it was discovered by a guy named Mac Brazel, who was a rancher. He didn't own the ranch, but he was the foreman. And he went out one day to take care of things and found this strange debris. And that probably was July 3rd when he found the debris.
Okay.
And he then, of course, realizing it was strange, and he was very familiar with balloons and things from the Air Force, and that's an important point I'll get to. So he went into town. Town was about 70 miles away in Roswell. He lived northwest of there. New Mexico then was very sparsely populated in that part. So he got into town. He didn't have a phone either. And talked to the sheriff, of course, and said, you know, what had happened. The sheriff immediately realized it was important and called the base at Roswell and said, you know, there's a guy you should talk to. The commanding officer at the base sent his intelligence officer there and said, you know, go over there and talk to him. His name was Jesse Marcel. He talked to Mac Brazel and said, looked at, and he brought a piece of debris with him, and he said, you know what, I should go out there and take a look. So he talked to his commanding officer and said, yeah, this looks important. We should look into this. So he, Marcel, took another guy and named Cabot, and they drove out with the rancher that day to the ranch to look at what he had found. And they stayed overnight, actually, to do it because it was such a long drive. Well, the you know, it's a long story, but basically they saw the debris field the next day, which was quite long. It was at least a quarter mile in length, with lots of debris scattered over it, though scattered, you know, not continuous debris.
Right,
quarter mile.
Right.
Very strange. Light but strong. not necessarily an object visible. It was all broken up. They brought some of it back to the base. And why do we know about it? Because on July 8th, the commanding officer, Blanchard, issued a press release that said the 509th Bomb Group, that was the bomb group at the station at the base, has got one of these flying discs. They weren't called UFOs back then, or they were called flying discs. And we have one in our possession, and we're sending it to higher headquarters.
Wow.
Imagine that. The Air Force actually put out that press release from Roswell. That was early in the afternoon on July 8th. A few hours later, at higher headquarters, which for them was in Fort Worth, the commanding officer there, Roger Ramey, undercut that press release and said, no, they just found a weather balloon. They misinterpreted a weather balloon as this debris. So nothing to see here, folks. Just go away.
Oh, wow.
And that, amazingly, because it was a different era, that buried the story for the next 30 years.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. That is amazing. So what do you think of the report that came out?
As I said, it buried the story for 30 years. Then Marcel began to talk about the case.
Right.
And people began to look into it. And in the late 70s. By the early 90s, there was so much information. So many people had been interviewed. I've interviewed myself, some of the old retired military guys, that it was impossible to ignore. The press was covering it. The public was interested. TV programs were being done. The government felt it actually had to react to UFOs, which it hadn't done since the late 60s. So they put out a report, a first report, in 1994, not in June, that tried to explain it away. And it didn't work. So the mystery continued. And there was a crescendo building in June of 1997, which was the 50-year anniversary of the sighting.
Yeah.
And so the Air Force felt compelled to put out another report. Imagine that. They put out a report to say, this is the definitive report, and then 3 years later, they put out another report. And that's the one that came out, you know, that we're talking about now.
Yeah.
That claimed that, well, yeah, people did see bodies at the crash site, but in fact, they were just crash dummies we were testing.
Oh, okay. All right.
And they were confusing. And by the way, those dummies weren't in 47. They were actually 10 years later, but they got confused about the timeline.
Oh, I see.
And all this stuff.
Okay. All right, Mark, hang on a second, okay?
Sure.
All right. We are talking with Mark Roediger, and he is the president and scientific director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. And we're talking about UFOs, and we've got more to talk about right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here, and we're talking with Mark Roediger, who is the president and scientific director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. And Mark, welcome back.
Hey, yeah, good to be back, Nick.
Let's talk a little bit about the CIA's UFO history, which you wrote about.
Yes, it's a notorious history.
Yeah.
The most important thing that the CIA did was to hold a meeting in January of 1953 create a policy to debunk UFOs. And the reason that happened is because in the summer of 1952, there were a series of UFO sightings over not just the U.S., but right over Washington, D.C., and the CIA became concerned that there were potentially sightings, so many sightings, that they swamped the phone lines with people reporting. You know, they didn't have the kind of reporting system that we have now in this country. Right? So, and they thought of, cool, who else? That the Soviets could do the same thing somehow. They could confuse us and lead to a sneak attack, potentially. They also thought that, and this is really, was, you know, you might say, well, there's maybe some logic in that. But they also believed, per the general paranoia in the Cold War days, that UFO groups and individuals could be secretly working to subvert the government. You know, maybe not consciously even. They were doing it, you know, just by studying UFOs and questioning whether the government was releasing all the information. You know, that could be a problem. So for all those reasons, they held this meeting with some very top-level scientists. Dr. Hynek was there as kind of a junior member. And the senior group recommended that the government downplay as much as possible UFOs. They didn't worry at all about scientifically investigating them. In fact, that they thought that UFOs really could all be explained. There's no mystery here at all.
Right.
So the idea, and the critical thing was to get the public not interested in UFOs. In fact, they talked about things like using Walt Disney, the company, to put out essentially propaganda about UFOs. And they also recommended keeping an eye on UFO groups and organizations, which did then happen in the 1950s and 1960s. So the Air Force, up until that time, had done some reasonable work investigating UFO sightings. After that was what's called the Robertson Panel. H.B. Robertson was the scientist who led it. Then the policy changed. And it while some investigations were done, well, like the Socorro case in 64 in New Mexico with a policeman seeing a landed UFO, for the most part, the idea was come up with any crazy explanation that's possible to get rid of all the cases, try not to classify anything as unidentified, because we don't want the public to be interested in UFOs.
Mm.
And so that's the worst thing they did. Beyond that, let me flip it over.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine the following. People are seeing strange things in the sky, including military pilots. Scientists even are seeing them. People are sometimes measuring and taking photographs. Would you think that the country's military and civilian intelligence agencies should be not only aware of that, but that they should be looking into it? Well, the answer is, how could they not be, right?
Yeah.
But the problem is, they didn't. As far as we know, unless there was some secret project that we haven't yet uncovered, they put their heads in the sand. They said, no, we're not going to look into what these people are reporting. You know, we're going to ignore it. And we're going to go about our business and worry about the Soviets, which admittedly was a more direct, you know, threat.
Sure.
But still, they ignored this interesting, if true, not super concrete evidence for things being seen. But again, being seen by very reliable observers, you know, their own pilots, their own military men, etc.
Wow. So it's an interesting history. Now you wrote this piece. What was the history that you looked into?
Well, in the 1990s, you know, after the Cold War, the intelligence agencies, including the CIA, began to open up their archives. You know, the Soviets did that after the Berlin Wall fell, and some of that began to happen here in its own way. And so the CIA tasked one of its internal historians, a guy named Gerald Haynes, to write a history of the CIA's involvement with UFOs. So he wrote that, and there was an unclassified and a classified version. I've never seen the classified version, but the unclassified version came out of, you know, in the mid-90s. So we looked at it, and you know, some of it was okay, but there was one crazy thing in it that I knew I had to investigate.
Okay.
So let's go back to the 1950s when the U-2 spy plane was developed.
Okay.
Which was the first plane, of course, that could fly at high altitudes, take photos. This is before satellites. And so it was sent over the Soviet Union to take photos. One was shot down. A guy named Gary Powers, the pilot, you know, was held by the Soviets for a while. The Haynes claimed, because somebody, an old guy, you know, retired guy at the CIA told him, that, oh, back in the 50s, maybe up to half of all UFO sightings were caused by the U-2 spy plane. Well, the U-2 spy plane flies really high in the sky, but it's a plane. It doesn't, it's not a missile or anything. It's not a disc. It's a plane. And not only that, I know from studying the files that there's no way that's actually a crazy claim.
Mm.
So what I did was I contacted a guy named Major Robert Friend, who was the head of Project Blue Book. Project Blue Book, which I'm sure many listeners have heard, was the name of the main UFO project.
Right.
Looked at UFOs.
Right.
Major Friend got along very well with Dr. Hynek. He was one of the good guys in the project, tried to do the best he could given those limitations I mentioned. So I called up Major Friend back in the 90s. He was still around. And I said, I read him the relevant part of Haynes' comments. And he laughed uproariously. And he said, you know, I can't quite quote him, but the upshot is, he said, no way. That he's completely off base. There's no way that half the sightings we got were caused by the U-2 spy plane. Here's the guy who ran the program telling you that.
Yeah.
Right? Okay? Because he knows what the characteristics are. And the other reason is lots of people reported UFOs close to the ground. You know, things that landed, things that they could see next to a tree, you know, things that were within their field of view, not high up in the sky. The UFO, the U-2 over the United States never flew that low because it didn't want to be seen here. It was a secret plane.
Right.
So there's an example of an official history that at least on that point is completely inaccurate.
Wow. So is this ever going to be cleared up? Are we ever going to solve any of these mysteries, Mark? What do you think?
Well, I'm hopeful. Let's say I'm more hopeful than I was maybe 3 years ago because the New York Times reported back in December of 2017 on the videos that were taken by Navy pilots, which were taken, of course, when the people were visually seeing UFOs and they were being picked up on radar. And this is a story that it broke with the Times. We had actually heard about it before that in the UFO community. But we know that pilots have always seen UFOs. I mean, I just saw a report last week from a pilot from one of our, either FedEx or UPS, two pilots flying over Mexico that videoed a light outside their window, a UFO. So they're still being seen from the air. Well, these were naval pilots in more than one incident that saw a UFO because they were vectored there by radar, and then their cameras on the plane picked up the UFO. And the incredible thing is that this stuff got released, and then the pilots were willing to talk about it and stand behind these statements, and the military didn't stop them from doing so. No, they were all, you know, out of the military by then. Well, this has been gaining momentum, the interest in this, in the last 2.5 years, so much so that just like 2 days ago, the Senate Select Intelligence Committee has asked for the government for next year to begin a systematic effort to report on what it knows about unexplained sightings of things. Now, their focus is on unexplained technology that could be from our adversaries, China, Soviet Union, and so forth, but they leave it open for, you know, essentially whatever the cause is for this technology. And so that kind of official interest is totally new in the UFO community and UFO history since the 60s in Blue Book. So that does give me some hope, because otherwise, I will say, UFOs are very hard to study. And the reason is they don't appear in any pattern.
Right.
You know, you could do experiments in the lab with almost every other science kind of thing. You can go out, my undergrad degree is in astrophysics, so you can go out with a telescope and study stars and on, et cetera, et cetera. But we can't just go out at a certain time and say, we're going to go out and study UFO tonight. Can't do it. And that's been a tremendous hindrance for us, you know, all these years. But so getting official interest is for all the obvious reasons, extremely important, and I'm just hoping this continues.
Mm. Wow. It's fascinating stuff. It really is. Tell me a little bit about what you think of the declassified UFO videos that were taken by the Navy pilots at the Pentagon.
I think they're legitimate. I think that that they're the tip of the iceberg. You know that that they're not easily explained as Chinese drones, or even our own drones being tested against our pilots. You know, it doesn't make sense they would do it in the way it occurred.
Right.
So I think they're unexplained. I don't think they're also, you know, a distant aircraft or anything. You know, it's people have tried to debunk them. I've read through those efforts. I'm not convinced. But we need more data. And one problem is there is still secrecy. You know, there's a guy who ran a small UFO program in the government that was funded through efforts by Harry Reid, the former senator from Nevada.
Right.
And called ATIP. And Louis Elizondo was the guy who ran this program. But the program's results are still basically classified. You know, these videos have been released, but the program behind it and the whatever else this program was doing with Elizondo says was studying UFOs. This stuff has not been released, and not only that, we don't even have the Navy report on these videos and these sightings. So we're still very much in the dark as to the details on these things.
Yeah.
And without that, I understand why, a scientist or who is neutral to the subject, oh, well, maybe UFOs are interesting, maybe they're not, I don't know,
yeah,
is going to say, you know, show me your data on this stuff. You know, then I'll get really interested.
Right,
and
right,
at this
right.
point, there isn't much.
Right, okay. Listen, Mark, fascinating stuff talking to you. President of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. Is there a website that people can go to?
www.cufos.org, kufos.org.
Kufos.org. Okay, Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you very
okay,
much.
Okay, take care.
Rick.
There you go. Mark Rodiger, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN, and we'll be back.